good to see you back from winter break. And we are now on the third week or third part of a four-part series in which we look at Medrash that talks about Ki Mal'ah Ha'aretz Chamas, the divine decision to destroy all the life that he had created. And the question is, when God says Mal'ah Ha'aretz Chamas, that the land is filled with Chamas, what does filled actually mean? That's what our Medrash is bothered by. And we link it to four different verses found in, around Tanakh, one from Yechezkel, one from Amos, two from Eo, from Job. Here, we're going to use a verse from Amos to explain what full of Hamas means. And along the way, we're going to get insight into the sin and punishment of Noach's generation. Now, the truth of the matter is that this is a very short medrash that we have for this week. And I looked at it initially and said, oh, I guess I'm going to do two this week. For sure I'll be able to fit more than one in. And then I started going through it and realized there are a few additional things here that aren't so obvious at the outset. This is one of those midrashim that quotes a verse from elsewhere in Tanakh. However, it's not to explain the verse elsewhere in Tanakh. Unlike some of the others we've seen where they'll quote a section from somewhere else and the midrash is really about that, trying to explain some problem, some nuance in that other verse. And then, by the way, we'll, you know, attach it to our discussion. That's not what's going on here. These verses from Amos are actually straightforward. You could learn the book of Amos, and some of us did together, right? When we went through Treyasar for a few years, we learned Amos. You could go through chapter 5 in Amos that this is taken from and understand it just fine without any reference to Noach. However, it's going to shed light on what's going on with us. So we're bringing in Amos really to explain Noach. That's point number one. Point number two is something we've seen before, which is that only one verse from Amos is going to get quoted in our Medrash. But if you really want to understand the association between Amos and Noach, you can't make do without one verse. You need to see the greater context. Remember that we had that one where we associated sentences, I think, from Yechezkel. It was either Yechezkel or Eov, in which we quoted a passage and said, well, this relates to Noach. And the verse itself didn't really give us any indication until we saw that the preceding verse used the words Tzadik Tamim. And we said, oh, that's the Noach connection. But the Medrash didn't bother to tell us that because it assumed that we knew the context or we were going to look it up. That's what's going on here. The reason why Amos has to do with us is not found in the verse that's quoted in our Medrash as much as it's found in the greater context. So we're going to start by setting it up with source number one, in which we see what the greater context is in Amos. In general, in the fifth parak, the fifth chapter of Amos, the prophet speaks of seeking God. And then he indicts the Jewish people three times for corruption. And that's the section that we have here. He indicts them for warping justice, leading God to warp the way that he orders the cosmos, as we'll see. Number two, you warp justice in order to enrich yourselves, and therefore you will not benefit from your wealth. Shades of last week's theme, as I'll spell out. And then third, you warp justice by harming the righteous. Therefore, the Navi, the prophet who's supposed to teach justice, he's not going to be able to advise you. Those are the three components here, all stemming from their corruption, the way that they warp justice. When I say warp justice, what I mean is that their courts produce verdicts that are biased in favor of the powerful and that harm the indigent. That's specifically what we're talking about.
The courts are corrupt.
The courts are corrupt, precisely. So let's take a look at source number one, please, and see what we find. It starts out talking about God. Osei chima uchsil, v'hofeich laboker tzalmaves, v'yom laila hechshich, hakorei lemei hayam v'yishpechem al pnei ha'aretz, Hashem Shemo. He, God, makes the Pleiades and Orion. Right? These are constellations. He transforms into morning the shadow of death, and day into night he darkens. He summons the water of the sea and spills it across the land. God is his name. Okay. What is God doing in this sentence, in sentence 8? What is this about?
Operating the universe.
Operating the universe? Okay. More than that. It's true, but there's more. Changes it, right? God is described as creating. He's also described as transforming, right? And what type of transformation in particular are we observing here?
Punitive.
Right. Punitive. He's punishing, right? He transforms into mourning. The shadow, although there, the first one, transforming into mourning the shadow of death, suggests bringing daylight. That's actually a positive. But day into night he darkens is a negative, and then summoning the water of the sea and spilling it across the land, which obviously reminds us of
the flood,
right? These are punitive activities. As part of God governing the universe, he will bring day, he will also bring night, and the reference to the shadow of death is indeed a reference to nighttime. And he floods the earth. So that's sentence number 8. It's part of, again, the first indictment for corruption, in which they are told, you warp justice. God is going to warp the way that he orders the cosmos. He's going to warp day and night, water and land, strength and weakness. That's found in sentence 8, as well as in sentence 9. Technically speaking, if you were to open a book of Amos, as it's originally recorded in the scroll, you would find a paragraph break between sentence 8 and sentence 9. If you see the letter Samach in the Hebrew after sentence 8, after Pasuk Chet, that denotes that there's actually a little bit of a break there. Nonetheless, the theme continues in sentence 9, describing God. Hamavlig showed al uz, vishod al mivtsar yavo. This is another way in which God reorders the cosmos. He is mavlig. Mavlig is to elevate, to strengthen. He strengthens destruction against the mighty, and he brings destruction upon the fortress. Those who thought they were powerful, those who thought they were immune, are the ones who are going to suffer. Yes?
It's like saying that God is the judge here. You people, you have your courts and it's all corrupt, but God is the ultimate judge and he is going to he has more power over you. He's more powerful.
Right, so I think that's definitely one piece of this, is the statement of you aren't the ultimate arbiters, there's a God who's watching. But I think there's a second step here. I think that he's sort of, and it's probably more poetic than anything else, but he's imputing a sort of ethical value to the normal cause and effect of things, and saying that the way the world normally works, the things you normally expect to see happen, that people who are powerful are going to be able to do things that people who are vulnerable cannot do. Or that the sun is going to set and the moon is going to come up and that the sun will rise in the morning and the darkness will go away and that the land will be the land and the sea will be the sea. These are not just status quo, but they're also the way things ought to be. And that you warped the order of things by taking justice and turning it on its head. And therefore, I'm going to take the way things ought to be, the cause and effect that you have come to expect by which you function day to day, and I'm going to turn that on its head. You thought you were going to get night, it's going to be day. You thought you were going to get day, it's going to be night. You thought that was dry land, it's going to be water everywhere. That is this sort of overturning of the status quo. It's not just I am powerful and therefore, boy, are you in trouble, but it's measure for measure. You corrupted things, I'm going to corrupt things. That sort of idea. Now, yeah.
So the expectation, mm-hmm. The normal expectation is you go to court, you have justice. So the normal expectation is there's day and there's night. And this is what I was reading, I think it's somewhere in the Kabbalah or something, it's the as below, as above. It's like you created this below, and so now above is going to come upon you.
Right, and there's a great deal to be said about that idea. Absolutely. Now, I want to take a minute, though, to explain what Pleiades and Orion are doing here in this passage from Amos. First of all, I hope I'm pronouncing Pleiades right. It sounds right to me. Yes, Shana? Okay. So, Pleiades and, I got Shadus Hesher, all is good. So Pleiades and Orion are always together in Tanakh. They're consistently referenced together, and they're close together in the sky. In the northern hemisphere, the Pleiades shine all night in November. That's their great time of ascendancy. Orion is right nearby, but shines its most in the sky between January and March. So keep that in mind as you take a look at source number 2, please. A passage from the Gemara in Brachos, which says, Il male chamashel kisil, if not for the heat of kisil, which is Orion, lo niskayim olam mipnei tzina shel kima, the world could not withstand the cold of the Pleiades. The il male tzina shel kima, and if not for the cold of the Pleiades, the world could not withstand the heat of Orion. The assumption is that heavenly bodies actually exert influence upon the weather here on Earth. Which is not strange. I mean, it sounds strange to me because I don't tend to think of Mars as influencing my weather. But realistically, when you understand that the moon exerts tidal pulls, and when you understand that the sun affects the level of heat here on Earth in a very direct way, it's not odd for me to think that God has also offered other celestial entities a voice, so to speak, in what happens right here. That's where astrology fundamentally comes from. It's the idea that there are other bodies out there that are able to exert a pull of some kind upon what's going on here on Earth. So what you're seeing here is not astrology. What you're seeing here is meteorology. The idea that the weather is somehow involved with, or these entities are involved with, the weather. So if I see that the Pleiades are in force in November when the cold season begins, then I say, oh, the Pleiades are a force for cold. And if I see that Orion is in the sky in March, when if I'm in the Middle East, things are warming up. Here, the snow is just getting started. But if they're in March when the Middle East is warming up, then I say, oh, it must be a force of warmth. And the idea is that there's a need for balance, and God has created forces that provide cold and forces that provide heat. I am sure there are layers of other meaning here that I'm entirely missing. But that's a simple and straightforward read of source number two. Interestingly, if you look at the Wikipedia page, resource of all wisdom, called Pleiades in Folklore and Literature, they quote a Berber adage. The Berbers, recall, are the pre-Arab population in North Africa. So they used to have an adage that linked the rise of Pleiades with the cold. I brought you the reference here in source number 3, so you can take a look at that there. But it wasn't just a Jewish idea that the Pleiades were associated with cold and that Orion would be associated with heat. It's something that's culturally found in general in the Middle East, in North Africa, in those days. So that when he references here that God makes the Pleiades and Orion, that's not a statement of divine might at random. God is powerful. Looked, he created these constellations. Rather, it's a statement of he creates the balance of hot and cold. That's what Amos is saying. When he says God creates Pleiades and Orion, it means God creates hot and cold, or cold and hot, I have to get them in order, and also day and night, and also water and land. All of these are part of this balance that he's referring to here. It's the balance of these different elements. So that's all in that opening set, those opening two verses, sentence 8, sentence 9. But Amos continues. We're still in source number 1. Sanu vashar mochiach vedover tamim yisa'evu. He now has shifted from describing God's response to their corruption to describe what they do. What is this corruption? So they hate at the gate the mochiach. I translated mochiach as educator. That's my personal bias. The word mochiach is usually used in a stronger way. People usually render mochiach and tochacha as rebuke, someone who scolds. The reason I don't appreciate that translation maybe enough is because really it's from a word that we also associate with the verb lahochiach, which is to prove, to demonstrate. So when the Torah says, Hocheach tochiach es amisecha, when it says, if you see, if someone has sinned against you, if someone has harmed you, you shouldn't hate him. It says, "Hocheach tochiach es amisecha," you shall educate the person. It doesn't mean yell at. It doesn't mean humiliate. It doesn't mean rebuke. It means educate, demonstrate to the person what the proper attitude is, what the proper behavior is, as opposed to hating them for their sin. So I take mochiach as an educator. And we'll see that play out in the Medrash. But in sentence 10, he says, the sin of this generation is that they hate the person who educates. They hate the educator at the gate. V'dover tamim yisa'evu. And they abhor the one who speaks of completeness. That's sentence 10. And then we go back in sentence 11 to talk about what's going to happen to them. Lachain, therefore, Yan boshaschem al dal, because you trampled the needy. Umas as bar tikhu mimenu, and you took his grain from him. Bate gazis binisem veloseish bubam. He says, I have news for you. You have built houses of hewn stone, you won't dwell in them. Karme chebed netatem velotishtu es yenam. You have planted desirable vineyards. Once again, we talk about people planting vineyards, which we've now done repeatedly in our discussions about righteousness and wickedness. You planted desirable vineyards, and you will not drink their wine. So, as a result of the fact that you rejected rebuke, this is what's going to happen to you. You will not benefit from that which you have produced. You're not going to benefit from your wealth. So first he said, I'm going to warp heaven and earth. I'm going to warp the cosmos because you warped justice. Now he says, you tried to enrich yourselves, therefore you will not benefit from your wealth. And that's the second piece. Note, by the way, if you remember the instructions that are given to the Jews when they go out to war, and the reasons that are given to justify not going out to the battlefield, right? There are three. Before we talk about the one who is afraid of battle, what are the three justifications given for not going out to war? Right. Person, the male, we're talking about a male there, who has gotten married and not yet been with his wife for the first year. He's supposed to stay with her. That's one. That one is not referenced here, but the other two are planting the house, and then he doesn't get to dedicate it, planting the vineyard, and he doesn't get to drink the wine. So this is sort of a concept of the pleasure that is his due. It's his right. And God says, too bad, you warped the order of things, I will warp the order of things. That's the idea here. I'm going to come back to that sentence. There's more to say about that, but let's go through the sentences here first. Sentence 12, Ki adati rabim pishechem, because I know that your sins are many. Va'atzumim chatoseichem, your sins are great. Sorei tzadik lokhei chofer ve'evyonim bashari, two besiegers of the righteous, collectors of ransom, warping the justice of the needy at the gate. So they are once again rebuked for harming, and the conclusion of it is, I didn't bring it here, but in sentence 13, the way it concludes is that the prophet who teaches justice is not going to be able to advise you. The prophet will not advise you either. So, we spent a lot of time on sentences 8 and 9. We've seen God warning that he is going to reverse the order of things in the cosmos. And then in sentence 10, he rebuked them for hating the educator at the gate. What is the gate for us within Tanakh? What does the gate represent?
The community meets.
Good. Meeting place of the community and often a place of justice. I gave you some examples of it in source number 4. Lot is at the gate of the city when he meets the angels that have come to visit. Chamor when he wants to convince the people of the city of Shechem that they ought to go along with his plan to be able to keep Dina and to be able to interact with the children of Yaakov and they should all have a bris milah, he goes out to the gate of the city to gather everybody. Another example you could bring, I didn't bring it on the sheet, is that Ephron and Avraham, when they negotiate the purchase of Marat HaMachpelah, that's also at the Shar, that's at the gate. Shovtim v'shotrim t'tein lecha b'chol she'aracha, you shall place judges and officers at the gates of your cities. The rebellious son is brought out to the gate of the city for rebuke. The story in Ruth and Ruth, when Boaz wants to make the arrangement to be able to marry Ruth, so he goes out to the elders at the gate, and so on and so forth. There are numerous examples you
can
bring.
That's a meeting place,
obviously. That is right. It's the public square, is really what it is. So they reject this education at the gate. We actually mentioned the gate in two places here. In sentence 10, they reject the one who would teach them. And in sentence 12, that's where they warp the justice of the needy. Right there in the town square. There's no embarrassment. They're doing it right at the gate.
Openly.
Mm-hmm. That's the idea. There is no shame. It's not, you know, some back alley. It's out there for everybody to see. Notice also in sentence 10, there's something that's going on here in terms of their relationship with the one who would educate them. Are they just ignoring the person?
And the speaker.
They hate him, right? There's animosity. Son U, they hate. Yisraevu, they abhor. There's an outright animosity at the one who would educate them. So as I said in the beginning, these sentences read straight, so to speak. Meaning, I don't come away from this with questions. Maybe you do. I shouldn't assume my conclusion here. Do you see anything here that's particularly troubling in this passage, something that's inconsistent or troublesome? Don't be prejudiced by my own sentiments. I think it's a relatively straight section in Amos, in which he's saying, you were corrupt, therefore I'm going to corrupt the order of things. You didn't listen to the rebuker, therefore the Navi, the prophet, isn't going to be able to help you. Right? It's relatively straightforward. And as I said in the beginning, I don't really think our Medrash is bothered by questions in Amos. But it sees correspondences between Amos and what's going on with Noah. Which correspondences do you see here? Sorry? Tamim, good. So we noted here in sentence 10 that the one who would rebuke them is called Tamim. That's the one they don't listen to, is Noah. And by the way, we're going to go then with the view, remember we've seen two different views, but this is within the view that Noah actually does try to instruct them. Right? We've seen two different trends. This is one of them. What else associates this? We already saw one of them. We commented on one of them when we started reading.
Summons the water.
Is sentence 8. He summons the water and spills it across the land. By the way, in case you were wondering about what this has to do with Orion and the Pleiades, so I gave you one association, because they govern cold and hot, the order of things in the universe. But take a look at source number 5, which puts them in direct context of the flood. Bishnas Sheish Meos Shana L'Chayei Noach B'Chodesh Hasheni B'Shiv'a Asar Yom L'Chodesh. The Torah tells us with great precision on what day the flood began. It's Noach's 600th year. Happy birthday. The second month and 17th day of the month, we assume, is not within Noach's life, within Noach's year, but rather now we're talking about a broader calendar, so we're shifting calendars. It's Noach's 600th year. Pause. And then, in terms of the general calendar, it's the second month, the 17th day. The problem we have is we don't know what the first month is. What are the candidates for the first month? Nisan and Tishrei. Right? Tishrei is supposed to be, Talmudically, the beginning of the world. Nisan is, for us, the Jewish calendar is supposed to begin in the month of Nisan. And so we get two different views. I only brought you Rabbi Yoshua there, but if you were to continue in this excerpt, you would find Rabbi Eliezer with the opposing view. But Rabbi Yoshua says, Oso hayom shiva asar bi'iyar haya. It was the 17th day of the month of Iyar, meaning that Nisan is the first month, meaning this is what time of year?
Spring.
The springtime. Yom Shemazal Kima Shokea Bayom Umayanot Mitma'atin. He says, it's when the Pleiades set during the day and the springs shrink. Because again, the Pleiades, as we talked about, represent cold. And therefore, cold is receding. The waters are receding as well. The rainy season is over. That's what's supposed to happen. But as we said, mitoch sheshinu maasehen, because they altered their deeds. They went against the order of things. They corrupted justice. They abused the needy. Shina HaKadosh Baruch Hu aleihem maasei bereishis. Hashem altered the deeds of creation. Ve'ela mazal kima bayom. He elevated the mazal. Mazal, taking it to mean constellations. Mazal in general, that's the root of the word mazal. I have an Israeli cousin who refuses to wish people mazal tov because he says that it's astrology. He says it's a pagan thing.
Mm.
Sorry? He says other nice things. Don't worry.
He's
good. Yeah, I don't remember offhand what his replacements are, but he has nice replacements. But but God takes the mazal, the constellation of the Pleiades, and he elevates it during the day for them. The result is bringing on the cold and bringing on the rain. V'natal shnei kochavim mikiman. He took two stars from the Pleiades, Ve'vima Bula Olam, and he flooded the world. So that here you have the Talmud making a direct link between Kima and Kisil, the Pleiades, as well as Orion, its constant partner in Tanakh. And that will add another level to the association of this passage with Noach.
Slide aside. Where do we get the fact that this was the second month of the 17th month? Where do they get that?
The biblical text. That's the quotes of the verse.
Oh, right.
Yeah. There are more associations, though. Like we saw last week when we quoted the verses from Iyov, from Job, we talked about those who had been wicked working the land, producing wine, producing oil, and then not getting to benefit from their work. Right? So we see that here. The theme is here in sentence 11. They plant vineyards and they don't get to benefit from them. They build houses and they don't get to live in them. And of course, what's their sin? Hamas. Right? It doesn't use the word Hamas. But it speaks of abuse of the vulnerable, which is, you know, the theme of for the beginning of Parshat Noach. So, having now familiarized ourselves with the middle of chapter 5 in Amos, we now turn to our Medrash. Source number 6. As I said, when I first looked at this Medrash, I said, I'm going to get two done, and we're half an hour in, and we haven't even seen the Medrash yet. So, source number 6. Vayomer Elokim, it begins, and God said, and they quote immediately a part of what we've seen, specifically sentence 10 from the 5th chapter of Amos. Sanu bashar mochiach v'dover tamim yisa'evu. They hate the educator at the gate. The speaker of completeness they abhor. What is this referring to? Dahava Amar Lahon, because he, Noach, used to say to them, Rekim, empty ones. Atem manichin misha kolo shover arazim umishtachvim le'etz yavesh. You abandon the one whose voice smashes cedars, and you bow to a dead tree. And because they were flooded in theft, they were wiped from the world. That's the constant refrain in these midrashim about the word mal'ah, right? This is now our third in a row with this refrain. They were flooded in theft, therefore they were wiped from the world. Shenamar, as the sentence says, Vayomar Elokim Lenoach, Kates Kol Basar Balafanai, Ki Mal'ah Ha'aretz Hamas, the end has come before me. So at first glance, this seems straightforward to me. We transplant Amos' rebuke of the agents of Hamas in his day to the agents of Hamas in Noach's day. And what Amos is doing is that he's telling the people of his time, the Jews who are his audience, he's saying, you're going to meet the fate of Noach's generation. There was a time in the past where people were corrupt, when they took advantage of others, and they were flooded out, and that's what's going to happen again. That's the simple read. And the idea that the generation resents rebuke could be read as the meaning of Mal'ah Ha'aretz Hamas. When you say the land is filled with Hamas, what is it that makes it filled with Hamas? So we saw one explanation was that everybody was bad, including Noah. That was our first medrash in this parak. And then we saw our second medrash that suggested it means that the land itself is complicit in the Hamas. such that when they plan things and when they work at it, they don't benefit from it. The land itself is stealing, so to speak. That was last week. And then here we get the explanation of Mal'aha Aretz Hamas. The land is filled with Hamas. Meaning, not only are people corrupt, but they won't listen when someone tries to instruct them, when someone tries to rebuke them. So there's absolutely no hope. They're completely full. Rita.
A quick question. When was
so, right. So he is towards the end of the first temple. Towards the end of the first Beis HaMikdash.
So this is like the second verse of the Shema.
Meaning?
In a way, because if you don't follow, you know...
Right, so that chapter in from right Deuteronomy 11, and if you don't listen, you got it. And that's like the prophets are filled with that message, absolutely. But there are some curious things going on in this Medrash. Take a closer look, please, and tell me what's wrong here. Yeah. Who threw in idolatry? If you look at the passages in which God says why he's destroying the earth, we don't find a reference to idolatry. We find a reference to Hamas. And however far we're going to stretch the definition of Hamas, and you can go pretty far, I don't see how that ends up being idolatry. Who brought idolatry into this? Good. What else? By the way, idolatry wasn't in Amos either. Meaning, Amos' rebuke that we are quoting here doesn't mention anything about idolatry either. It talks very clearly about the sin of corruption.
What about what it says, if you bow to a dead tree?
Yeah.
That could be.
The tree image... wait, but that's our Medrash. That's not found in the verses in Amos or in the verses in Noach. That's the Medrash's read of what Noach is saying, and I want to know where they got this from. The other problem that I have... is that it changes sins. Right? The opening line is, Noah rebukes them saying, hey, you're abandoning God and bowing to a dead tree. And because they were flooded in theft, they were wiped from the world. Not because they were flooded in idolatry, but because now we've restored theft to its rightful place as the sin of the generation of the flood. Yeah, well, make up your mind. Is it one, or is it the other? If it's really theft, then let him rebuke them for theft. Yes, Shana.
Something that I have on my mind is saying about the distinction between Gezel and Gneva, between robbery and theft.
That's interesting.
One is worse than the other. Because the robber at least has fears God and human beings equally, which is to say not at all, whereas the thief is more afraid of human beings than he is of God.
Right. So Shana is pointing to the fact that the Torah outlines two different categories of theft. One is called gezel, and the other is called geneva. Gezel implies taking something brazenly. Geneva implies a sneak thief, somebody who grabs something when nobody is looking. And there's a greater penalty given in the Torah for the latter, for the sneak thief, than for the former, the brazen thief. And one explanation that's offered, as Shana notes, is because at least the gazlan, the person who is guilty of taking things brazenly, is an equal opportunity offender. He's not afraid of people, he's not afraid of God. He goes out, grabs something, and moves on. Whereas the sneak thief is afraid of people and just not afraid of God. And therefore there's sort of a double insult involved. And therefore there's a greater penalty. However, since they're both involved defiance of God, I'm not sure... Yes, I could ultimately stretch theft further and say theft is an offense against God and a statement of lack of belief in God, because otherwise why would you be doing this? But realistically, you could do that with any sin then. And then all sins come back to idolatry. Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure why, with our punctuation, we've separated them. But if you took out the exclamation of saying, you know, I mean, you could read this as Noah said to them, the sedition of idolatry, you don't fear God and you bow down to idols. And in addition, and the, like it's not necessarily.
Which vi are you removing?
The lefi shayu.
Oh.
Okay. And because they flooded with theft, I mean, one could see it as because of the adultery and the theft, they were wiped from the world. I understand that the verb flooded.
Well,
is one combine those two, but why the... I'm just trying to...
Yeah. So the answer is, I hear you, but there are two problems. Number one, because then you've switched from second person to third person in the same line. Because it was second person, Noach addressing them directly, and then the next line is Lufisha Hayu, and because they were Shtufim, instead of Shehayitem, because you were. That would be one. And then the other is because this last line, Lufisha Hayu, is the refrain found in the previous two Midrashim as well, coming after the main point of the Midrash as a closing line. So I would find that to be a very difficult read. I have no objection to changing my punctuation. That, I made that up myself. Yes? Yes. Well, that plus you're abandoning the one whose voice shatters cedars.
Yeah.
You know, it's you're rejecting God in favor of a dead tree. You know, is this, in the language of the Medrash, a veiled shot at Christianity? Yeah, quite possibly. In other words, the bowing to a dead tree. You know, you could associate it with Asherah. You know, the Asherah, you know, tree worship of biblical times, but you could just as easily assume that it's not. You know, that it's a... I don't know. Maybe not. Worth noting also that the Shover Arazim, that God shatters cedars, remember that in the previous Medrash where we had Noach rebuking, right? We had him cutting down wood and saying that they're the cedars that, you know, that are going to be cut down. Interesting note. But the here's what I would suggest. Flip the page, please. Source number 7. And I tried to show you the different sins that are identified as causes for the flood. The first one is when the Torah says, "Vayikhu lahem nashim mikol asher bacharu," that they took women by force. Whoever they chose, they simply took the people who are involved in this, who are engineering the sins of the time. The second sin that's identified is that there is great evil in the land. The third sin that is identified is, and it's not really a sin so much as just a description of the disaster that's going on, is Vatishachet Haaretz Lifnei HaElokim. The land is destroyed. Destroyed not in the sense of it doesn't produce. That's not what destroyed here means. Destroyed is in the sense of corrupted, ruined before God. In that same sentence, Vatimalei Haaretz Chamas, and then the final reference is that again, vihinei nishchata, vayara lokim at haaretz vihinei nishchata. God looks at the land and it is destroyed. Again, destroyed meaning corrupted or ruined. Those are our descriptions leading up to source number 8. So we have taking women by force, general evil in the land. The land is corrupted multiple times. The land is filled with Hamas. And then God speaks to Noah. And look at what he says. Vayomer Elokim leNoah, in source number 8, God said to Noah, Kate kol basar balefanai, the end of all flesh has come before me. Ki mal'ah ha'aretz Hamas mipnehem, for the land is filled with Hamas before them. Ve'ninim ashchitam et ha'aretz, behold, I'm destroying them with the land. What did God omit? What did God identify as the cause, first of all?
Land is filled with
Hamas, right? That's the cause. He omitted anything else. Taking women by force, maybe you could argue that that fits in with Hamas. He omitted this general great evil that's going on in the land. God specifies Hamas when he speaks to Noah. So, perhaps one could suggest that what Noach is rebuking them for is not necessarily that which God tells Noach. In other words, Noach is living in this world. Noach knows exactly what's going on. For him, the whole range of sins that God has identified before, the land is filled with evil and so on, that's all there. But what Noach rebukes them for is what he sees. And what he sees is not just Hamas, but also that the land is corrupted, destroyed, ruined. Nishchata. What does nishchata mean? Take a look at source number 9. where the Gemara tells us that the word nishkata, which I translated as destroyed, has a very broad meaning. And the Gemara does this by linking the word where its root, shin, chet, tav, appears in various places in the Torah. And it says the word actually refers to specific sins. Tana Deve Rabbi Yishmael, it was taught in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael. Bechol makom shenemar hashchata, wherever hashchata is mentioned, eino ela devar erva v'avodazara. It refers to immorality. Going back to what we saw in 6:2, taking women by force. And it refers to idolatry.
And it's always both? One or the other? So this seems to be...
encompasses both.
It takes us back to our ratio.
One could lead to
the... I suppose. I mean, if you want to get into causal relationships, I think there are things you could definitely say. So Noah sees, even though God doesn't say to Noah, I'm destroying the world because of this hashchata, Noah knows it. He's living it. He sees it all around him. And that's what he's rebuking the people for. Even though it's not the sin that God speaks to Noach about, it's the sin that Noach observes. And so Noach, in our Medrash, turns to the people and says, look, you're bowing to a dead tree instead of the living God. And that's what he criticizes. That would perhaps be the idea, that's where this Medrash is getting it from. The idea that Hashchata, which Noach has to see around him, involves idolatry as well. The only problem that I have is, going back to the Medrash again, this business of the cedars and the dead tree, where does that come from? Is the Medrash just coming up with a creative way for Noach to tell them that they're, you know, choosing the wrong God? What is this? Yeah, Jane. Okay. Yeah. Well, Eitz Yavesh is found, right? Yeshaya, Val Yomar Ben Hanechar, etc. That he shouldn't say Ani Eitz Yavesh, which he's not supposed to say because he's not an Eitz Yavesh. But the Eitz Yosef commentary suggests that it goes back to the section in Amos. In going back to source number one, in sentence 9. God is described as the Mavlig Shod al Az, v'Shod al Mivtzar Yavo, the one who brings destruction against the mighty, right? And will bring destruction upon the fortress. So the idea here is not only that God is capable of demolition, but demolition of the mighty. And so he is described as the Shover Arazim. Not only does he break the trees, but the mightiest of the trees. The Erez is always used as the example of strength. So maybe that's the association. That's the only explanation that I've seen for why that is used as the description of God. And then contrasted with the weak dead tree, the effects of which we saw in the ice storm, doesn't have a whole lot of strength. So that could be what's going on here, that Noach is rebuking them for idolatry because that's what he perceives around him, even though it's not the sin that God picks out as the one that's going to cause the destruction. And so our Medrash has Noach saying one thing, but concluding line of the Medrash is, you should know, it ended because of theft. Could be. But, take a look at source number 10. And this is the last piece in this, and then I'll do a summary. Look at what Ramban does here, what Nachmanides does here. It's always interesting to see the way that Medrash makes it into the commentaries that we have on the Chumash. So Ramban, Nachmanides writes in source number 10, Chamas hu ha-gezel v'ha-oshek. This is theft and corruption. So far, so good. So to speak. V'nasan l'noach hatam b'chamas v'lo yizkir hashchasas haderech. He picks up on the fact that God only tells Noach about chamas. He doesn't mention the whole hashchata issue. Ki ha-chamas hu ha-chet ha-yadua ba-ha-mefursam, because chamas is the known and publicized sin. Bravo Seinu Amru, Shalav Nischatem Gizardinam, such that our sages said that this was the sin for which their verdict was sealed. Why? Ve'atam, the reason why this was what triggered God's rage, was Mibnei Shum Mitzvah Muskeles. Elam Bat Sarach Lenavim Azir. Because it's reasonable. You know not to steal. Right? What's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours. You don't get to take what's mine, I don't get to take what's yours. It's simple, basic, you know, hopefully by the time everyone is done being 2 years old, they have somewhat learned this lesson. They should have been able to figure this out. Eilem batzarech lenavim azhir, there's no need for a prophet to come warn them, hey, don't steal. Ve'od, and further, shu ra l'shamayim ulabrios, it is bad for heaven and for other creatures, meaning that is an act against both. It's a rejection of God, and it's a rejection of other people. God informed Noah of the sin for which the end was coming. The morning had arrived. Ramban is sensitive to the problem of the multiple sins being identified in the verse, but only one sin being mentioned to Noah directly. That's number one. Number two, Ramban is drawing on our Medrash, because our Medrash noted the problem. By listing two different sins, I'm not sure I made this clear before, by listing two different sins in our Medrash, saying Noach is rebuking for idolatry, but the ultimate punishment comes for theft, our Medrash is trying to alert us to the fact that there's more than one sin listed here in the Torah. And that's what Ramban is picking up on as well. And how do I know that Ramban is channeling our Midrashim? There are two giveaways in Ramban's commentary, one from this week, one from a previous week. This is a bonus question. Shayna.
So the closing quote is from the Midrash that we looked at last week about the morning arriving.
Good. That was the harder one.
Oh, well.
I thought, anyway. I thought remembering anything from before this week was difficult.
Is it the reason that it's a rational mitzvah? Like, obvious, it's an obvious thing if you do that.
Right. Which, what was the pasuk from Amos that our Medrash quoted? What did it say? They hate the educator, the person who's trying to rebuke them and instruct them and tell them what to do. Right? He says, that's what makes Hamas so terrible. You don't need an educator to teach you that. You're supposed to know that on your own. Right? The fact that they're not listening to the Mochiach, to the one who would educate them, may cause them to worship idols. Because they're not listening to the prophet when the prophet tells them that there's a God who created everything and so on. Fine. Not fine, but not as bad as theft, which they ought to have figured out. Even if they weren't going to listen to the Mochiach, they should have understood that theft is wrong. And so what Ramban is doing, by noting that and making that the difference between theft and the other sins, is he's fundamentally recognizing what our Medrash has done. That we've picked out the fact that they've rejected the educator, and that they still haven't learned even that which they ought to have known on their own. They ignored rebuke. And, as Shana said, in the end, he quotes this very odd word. That's the word that stands out. He says, God tells Noach about the sin, Shalav Bahaketz, for which the end has come, Higia Hatsifira, this odd word from Yechezkel, in source number 11, I brought you the sentence. It's a very odd word, which our Medrash used last week / 2 weeks ago. It was 31:1 in Bereishis Rabbah in our initial discussion of Mal'ah Ha'aretz Hamas. So Ramban is using our Medrash to do this, to make his point. Yes?
I just have a thing about the dead tree. It's a totally different take.
Go for it.
That God destroys the mighty, like the mighty people. He's more powerful than man. And he says to the people, and you worship the dead tree. But to me, the dead trees are the mighty people that he's destroyed. Like the people are looking to the people in charge. God is more mighty than these people, and he's destroyed them, and they're dead.
Interesting.
They have no power. God has all the power over all these people.
That's really interesting.
I
think I'm biased by the word mishtachavim, which is such a worship-oriented word that it makes me feel like this is to an idol.
Yeah. They do kind of worship them.
I hear you.
It's a different take.
Yeah, and you're entitled.
Can you explain to me, behold, the day comes, has arrived, the morning has come, the rod has blossomed, the villain has flowered.
Yes, or the villain or the villainee, yes, has flowered. Yeah. So that was part of the first medrash that we saw on Malach Haaretz Chamas, that the land is filled, and even Noach, if you go back and take a look at the notes from that one, you'll see there. But the message here, and I hope that the review sheet that I had sent out during the break was useful to sort of give us a sense of where things are from the first chapter. One thing that I gained from it was trying to do this structure with each medrash of message and methods and moral, which, has a nice alliteration to it. But the message here is primarily about Malach Haaretz Chamas, that it's this indication that they're not going to accept rebuke. That's the third unique aspect here, in addition to the first view that even Noach was bad, and the second view that the land itself was bad. There's a secondary message here, which is that there were many sins, including even idolatry, but that the sin which leads to their punishment is their theft, that they should have known about even after they rejected the rebuke of Noach. The methods that are used here, number one, is borrowing from Amos to explain what's going on here. And again, it only brought one little sentence from Amos. We needed to look at the broader section to see the associations, like the flooding of the earth, and the use of the word tamim. And also we saw, within the realm of methods, we saw Ramban using our Medrash's description of multiple sins. Even though God only gives Noach one of them. And the moral of it, I think, is fairly straightforward. It's a statement of when people refuse to listen to the mochiach, when people say, not only do I want to do what I want to do, but I'm not going to listen to anyone who's going to tell me otherwise, at that point, God declares enough. So on that very happy note, I apologize. Yes, B.
Yeah. Coming back to the idea of mochiach, the idea during the Holocaust, when people who escaped from concentration camps came back, their hometowns, nobody believes them. They don't have the tools. And the flood.
Yeah, the word mochiach is not exactly what I would apply there, but in terms of people not listening, right, that's more of a warning.
You know something. Yeah. My heart was being a service.